going to get out of the way that beam of light, Brendan, sisters. Brother Matthew spoke yesterday, and I don't know how we managed to do that. We've been led in various studies to consider a lot of the symbols. So the kind of idea of symbology in the scriptures we're going to be fairly familiar with by now. The aspect here that we're going to be considering of beasts is also something that we're quite familiar with in the scriptures as well. Beasts and animals, and the chief ones in the apocalypse is the lamb. You possibly have noticed how many times the lamb comes out, capital L, it's referring to the Lord Jesus Christ, and beasts. And incidentally, we won't be dealing with the four beasts that are referred to in chapter 6, better rendered, as Brother Matthew said yesterday, as the living ones. Need to keep a distinction of that if we're not familiar with it. There are the beasts, the apocalyptic beasts that we're going to consider very shortly. But what, you know, the King James translates beasts for what should be better rendered living ones. The cherubic living ones, the saints, in chapter 6. That's something that we might want to just make a note of. Yeah, it is something that we're pretty familiar with in the Bible, and actually, not just Bible students are familiar with the aspects of symbolizing particular things by an animal. We're quite familiar with this concept in secular dealings in the world. The nations of the world are really familiar with the aspects of beasts symbolizing particular countries. Actually, just a quick reference to Winston Churchill during the Second World War, when he was planning his attack against Germany. He actually was planning an attack from the southern part of Europe, and he called it the underbelly of Europe. The underbelly. And if you were to look at the map, we haven't got the map up now, but if you take a look at the map, if you look at where Europe is, you can actually kind of see the European continent like a beast, you know, as it comes down with Spain as its head sort of thing. And you can actually kind of imagine, if you've got an imagination, the peninsula of Italy like one of the legs of the beast. And actually, if you actually look at, again at it, you can actually see a beast represented in the actual Mediterranean, the ocean there as well. And that's kind of interesting, because as we've come to very briefly during the course of these remarks, there's a beast of the sea and there's a beast of the earth. And it kind of helps to look like that. But it's interesting that Winston Churchill, when he was planning that attack, he called it the underbelly of Europe. Now then, even Sunday school scholars, and we have some Sunday school scholars present here, would probably not only be familiar with the frog, but they probably would be able to tell you what the frog would probably represent as a nation. Certainly those of us living in Great Britain would be very well familiar with the frogs who are just across the water there in France. It's pretty popular. People, if you were to go out in the street and say, oh, they're about frogs, people say, oh, yeah, we know what you're talking about, the French. They might not take it as a compliment particularly, but that's what they are referred to. Again, everyone is pretty much familiar with the Russian bear. If you were to see a bear, then we would be quite familiar with that representation. I haven't put a cartoon up yet. I will put some cartoons up for the next animal that we're going to put up, the lion. But actually, in some of the cartoons, I should have put it up really, there is a picture of a bear being depicted by a bear. The lion, of course, can represent lots of different things. It can represent the Assyrian lion. It can represent the lion of the tribe of Judah, the Lord Jesus Christ. But I've chosen on this particular slide to say that it represents Great Britain, which it does. And there's a postcard from World War II when they were basically trying to trump up support from the young men and women of Great Britain in the time of the war to say, you know, your empire needs you, and this now, your country needs you. And Britain was depicted there as a lion, and the young lions are there. And on this other postcard, I thought it would be interesting to have a look at. It's called Responding to the Call, and the lions that are coming, you might not be able to see the writing, it's very small on the bottom, but it's got there Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Africa, India, the Commonwealth countries depicted by young lions coming to the old mother lion, Great Britain. So we're really familiar then with the aspect of beasts representing nations. Now, my proposition for this address is that the beast of the apocalypse is really simple. By the time I came to finish it, I was thinking to myself, well, I'm not absolutely sure now whether I've made this address complicated or not. But the difficulty that we do have is remembering the events and the dates. And we've been absorbing all the various difficult time periods. And if you're like Brother David, he's got a very good knack of being able to retain information and data. If you struggle to retain data like me, then don't worry about it. What we're going to try and look about is to try and get what we might call the basic principle. You know, Brother Steve, in his exhortation this morning, he referred to a brother who got open the book of Revelation and found it really difficult to get through. And I'm sure we all were like that at one time. I certainly was. I used to find it in Zechariah as well. You look into the symbols and you're really thinking, well, I don't know what it means. So if you take nothing from this address, bar the basic principle, we will go into some of the details, just to pack out a bit of the information and put some flesh on the bones, as it were. I don't think the doing that will be as important as if you can just get the basic principle of what these beasts mean, what they kind of depict. So when you're doing your daily readings, you can think, okay, I can't remember the people, the dates, the events, but I've got a fairly good working knowledge now, and then our readings become much more interesting to us. Now then, Brother Steve needs to shut his eyes when I press the button on this laptop now, because the difficulty is remembering the dates, and the answer is in the book of Daniel. Well, Brother Steve will have, you know, he's about to walk out now, because he says every address I do, I go to the book of Daniel. As far as this is concerned, I do believe that we've actually got the message in the book of Daniel. But we actually, before we go to the book of Daniel, the actual aspect of beasts, or these creatures, ferocious creatures, and incidentally, we see the difference when we talk about the lamb at the beginning. The lamb is the docile creature, symbolizing Christ. When we're looking at these beasts, we really look ferocious creature. And even that sort of thing, you know, the first slide we had up, you know, the beast with ferocious looking aspect, it depicts the nations. We can see immediately the truth versus the world, if you like. You know, truth and error, there are an antithesis there, depicted even by the beasts, which Yahweh has chosen in this last great apocalyptic message to you and me and to the saints through the ages. There's a quotation from Psalm 74, "Thou breakest the heads of Leviathan." And Brother Thomas, I think it was in Eureka, he said the dragon of Apocalypse 20 verse 2 is what is depicted there by this beast, this creature called Leviathan. Various things of what we might think this creature looks like. But he says it embraces all the intermediate dragonic manifestations of previous ages. Kind of a difficult sentence to get our heads around. But really what Brother Thomas is saying, some of the big empire powers are depicted by these creatures. There's another one in Isaiah 27. "In that day Yahweh shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea." And again, Brother Thomas says that these are figurative terms represented of the sin power in latter-day manifestation in opposition to Christ. Now, I think that phrase, the sin power, is one of our keys to an understanding of these beasts. If we can imagine them as being sin powers, a bit like, the devil, Brother Roberts in Christmas Day in his lecture saying, he says, the devil, not a supernatural being, but the scriptural personification of sin in its various manifestations among men. The governments of the world, in a sense, are the dragon powers that rule ferociously the age in which we live. Thus saith Yahweh, is another place. "I am against the Pharaoh king of Egypt, that great dragon." So there we've got it. You know, when we're looking at beasts, in that simple statement in Ezekiel 29 verse 3, we've got the actual key to the understanding when we come across a lot of these beasts. Egypt, because of its ferocity, was likened to a great dragon. And Brother Thomas says, the old serpent manifested as the dragon was the Pharaoh king of Egypt. He said, after the destruction of Egypt, and in other words, when Egypt lost her power from becoming a military entity in the ancient world, the dragon was transferred to Babylon. So Egypt was the great Leviathan, if you like, the great dragon that tormented the people of God in the days when she was at the zenith of her power. But when her power came to an end, the great power that came upon the scene and dominated the Middle East was Babylon. And Brother Thomas says, that's the dragon. That's that old serpent manifested as the dragon. The serpent was the result of the introduction of sin into the world, you remember. So these great powers, these sin powers, we go back to the serpent, which enticed man to transgress God's law, entering sin into the world. It becomes a symbol of the powers as they conglomerate together as big entities in the world. They're sin powers, and they refer to as dragons and so on. So what does the beast of the apocalypse mean? Well, as we've said earlier, we think essentially they mean the same thing. Essentially they mean the same thing, but they've got different sort of epochs. We'll have a look at that in a moment. But, and Brother David Hughes in his address yesterday made this particular point. There's two major major beasts, if you like, in the apocalypse. There's the dragon and there's the beast. The dragon is that political sin power. The beast is the Catholic power. We'll have a look at that. But they're very, very closely related. And in a sense, one comes out of the other. So, let's have a think about Daniel chapter 2 then. I said we're going to go to Daniel. Here we are in the book of Daniel, and this is something that most of us, if not all of us, are pretty much familiar with. The dream of Nebuchadnezzar. In chapter 7, we've got the same basic principles of the dream of Nebuchadnezzar referred to in beasts. So we've really got another correct understanding, haven't we? The silver, the gold, the brass and the iron, etc., of the image of chapter 2 equals those particular Assyrian lions, the Persian, Medo-Persian bear, the Grecian leopard, and that fourth beast equates with the iron legs of Rome. And there were 10 toes on the image, there were 10 horns on the beast. Lots of things to say about these things. We're basically only going to be scratching the surface, of course. So there's a kind of like putting all that together. Daniel 2, Daniel 7, and there's the interpretation. And I think we're all fairly familiar with that. If anybody wants to take notes and they would prefer to have the slide, just get a memory stick and you can have the slides if it saves you in any way. So we want to focus this afternoon on the fourth beast. Because this is the one that's going to give us our understanding of what the beasts of the apocalypse are all about. Remembering, of course, that the Assyrian Babylonian Empire gave way to the Medo-Persian, the Medo-Persian gave way to the Grecian Empire, and the Grecian Empire gave way to the Roman Empire. And we know the Roman Empire basically from our history books in school as Imperial Rome with Julius Caesar. But there's more to it than that, of course. There's a lot more to it than that. But that's the one that sticks in our mind. And currently, I always kind of look at that beast primarily as Imperial Rome, without the 10 horns and the little horn, which pushed down 3 of its horns and it emerged itself with an eyes and a mouth. We will look at that sort of thing in a reflective sort of way. But I kind of think of Imperial Rome when I see that beast. But the 10 horns and the little horn with eyes and a mouth are certainly ones which have a great deal of significance and actually came out of the Imperial Roman system. The key, Daniel chapter 7, as we find in lots of parts of the scripture provides its own interpretation. We go to it and we find a verse in here that gives us the key. Just like in Daniel chapter 2, we see, "Thou art the head of gold." Bang, we've got Nebuchadnezzar as well, and we can work out all the details from there on in. So Daniel wanted to know what this fourth beast, he was really disturbed about this fourth beast because it made war against the saints. It was a ferocious creature, it devoured, and it was a blasphemous creature, if you read Daniel chapter 7 at your own time, if you're not familiar with it. He sees 10 horns, and he particularly sees this little one which came up, and it disturbed him greatly. "I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints, and prevailed against them, until the Ancient of Days come." And I've underlined that, because that's our great clue, what we're going to look at. The reason it's our great clue is this. I'm just going to go back one there. "I would know the truth of the fourth beast. He beholds it making war until the Ancient of Days come." Okay? Now then, that means that beast continued a long period of time. Daniel saw this beast in, what was it, BC 500 something or other in Babylon. He sees this beast and he sees it in existence until the Ancient of Days come, which is Christ, the Lord Jesus Christ. So he sees this beast in continuous existence until Christ comes. That's our clue to our understanding of the book of Revelation. Keep that point in mind. It's important because it helps us understand it. Because I've got 2,700 years here. You know, some of the time periods I'm not going to be too exact on. Rome, apparently, according to tradition, was founded in about 700 BC by a man called Romulus. 700 and something, 12 or something like that. When Daniel really sees it coming onto the world scene after the Grecian Empire and coming to the zenith of its power, he's probably talking about BC 30. But the country of Rome itself had been in existence, you know, only in a much smaller way, for a longer period than that. So my question is, does Imperial Rome exist today? You know, if I said that beast, and we think about the Roman Empire, we think about Imperial Rome and the marching soldiers, and we say, well, does that empire exist today? And the answer is no. Well, yeah, it is, no. We don't see Imperial Rome today. We haven't got Caesars ruling the peninsula of Italy and throughout the extended empire. So, how does it continue? If Imperial Rome doesn't exist today, how do we say that that beast had a continued existence for upwards of 2,000 years? Daniel saw it in existence until Christ destroyed it. So how is it in existence if we know from history that Imperial Rome does not exist? And the answer must mean it must have different phases. It must have different phases, different periods of history. And Brother Roberts actually talks about the current state of the Roman Empire in a 10-toed divided state, i.e. Europe cross-continent, in a rickety condition. But it still exists. The fourth beast still exists today. Now then, I'm going to illustrate this. We'll go back to the map of Britain. Has Britain always had the same constitution and form of government, or constitution and form of government? Britain's been in existence a long period of time, but it has not had the same constitution for all that period. I've just taken some examples to try and demonstrate this position of this different phases. If you were to go right back to 440 AD, you can go back further than this, incidentally, but the information gets a bit sparse here, but we know that in about 440 to 1066, when the Normans came, and with William the Conqueror, the Anglo-Saxons were in existence. I must say that the Celts were still around. They were pushed into the confines of Wales and up into Scotland by and large, but the Celts were still there as well. But the Anglo-Saxons were dominant, and then the Normans came, as you're saying, with William the Conqueror from over on the continent and invaded Britain. It was still Britain, and they basically moulded it into the patterns they wanted to have it. Then came the Plantagenets. I mean, the Henry II, I think, he basically started uniting some of the Great Britain to a large extent. He defeated the Welsh quite successfully, and sort of brought it within the control of the greater British Empire. The Tudors there, that's probably more what people are familiar with, because one of the most famous Tudors was Henry VIII and his six wives. So that's a kind of a different period of history, and particularly when Britain, under the reign of Henry VIII, started a great fracture from Roman Catholicism, and so on. I'm putting bold text, Imperial Britain. That's probably one of the great days of Britain, sort of thing, just prior to 1837, even perhaps a little bit with the Hanoverians, when Nelson was sailing the seas, and Britain's empire was becoming great. So what I'm trying to illustrate is the kind of idea that as Britain developed, if we had beasts to represent Great Britain during these centuries, we probably have different things happening to them. Do you know what I mean? Do you know the kind of idea I've got in mind there? You know, you might have the basic lion, and you might have, I don't know, horns coming out of its head or something like that, or various things, and it would depict all those periods of time. Well, so as well with this fourth beast. It had different periods, and that's a kind of a chart there, but I could expand that chart, and I'll do so in a different slide in a few moments' time. But as we said, in BC 30, you could look at the Roman Empire and see Imperial Rome. By the time you get to the 4th century, and Brother Ben gave us quite a good exposition yesterday, I think it was Brother Ben, with the trumpets and the invasion of the barbarians, the Goths and the Visigoths and the Huns and the Vandals, which came into the empire and actually settled down eventually into the empire and took on, interestingly enough, the religion of the empire. Think about that. That's a really important point as well. When kingdoms invade and they establish themselves in territories like the barbarians did, normally they'd set up their own independent laws, independent governments, and they'd have nothing to do with anybody else. They keep it very much in you. This didn't happen when the barbarians came in. They basically absorbed the religion of the Roman Empire. So they stayed part of that Roman Empire. They stayed part of that fourth beast. It didn't break it up per se. It was absorbed into it in a sense. Yes, it did break up the power of the empire. The empire didn't have the exercise of dominion that it once had, but it didn't fracture it completely. It became part of it. Split up, if you like. Fractured, split, but not severely so, if that makes any sense. And you work your way down to the Holy Roman Empire in AD 799, and finally, the beast being destroyed in AD 2000 and... that one will remain for the chronologists to make a conjecture on when we think Christ will come and the various periods of time after that. But you get the idea. Now, I hope I haven't lost you in any of this sort of detail, especially with the British thing, because what I'm trying to say is we're looking at particular epochs as this fourth beast moved from one epoch to another epoch to another epoch. Okay? I kind of put like a timeline there with that BC 753, Daniel having his revelation, if you like, seeing the imperial aspect of Rome coming up in about BC 30. John wrote in about AD 98, the Apocalypse, and it's that bottom one, really, AD 98 to 2000 and something, when Christ comes to destroy that beast. So there is the AD 98 when John was given to the revelation of things which must shortly come to pass. John wrote in the days of imperial Rome, and he provides more details about the beast which Daniel saw. Daniel saw that fourth beast power. Daniel now gives more information regarding it, more historical information and characteristics of this fourth beast. They were there in embryo in Daniel's vision because Daniel saw the 10 horns upon the head of the fourth beast. And he sees this one little horn come up, which was the papal horn come up. He sees that. In a sense, John is given more details to supplement that particular vision which Daniel had. So from AD 98 to the days of Imperial Rome. Now the link with Daniel. It's interesting really because someone's already mentioned this during the course of this weekend, that there's a very powerful link with the apocalyptic beasts with Daniel. Both had 10 horns. Both were ferocious creatures. Both were persecuting. They were blasphemous as well. This little horn that we refer to on the beast of Daniel, it spoke great things against against God and wore out the saints of the Most High. It was blasphemous. And in the book of the Apocalypse, when Daniel sees the beast in chapter 13, it had lion, bear, and leopard characteristics. I can't remember which ones they were now, but feet of a roar of a lion, perhaps feet of a bear. You know what I'm talking about. The other thing that we want to make reference to, which isn't given, we're not given details of this in Daniel, I can't remember the writings of Brother Thomas where he says that maybe that this vision with the one ferocious looking beast with the 10 horns and the little horn, maybe that's not quite the right depiction. Maybe the beast really had 7 heads. Certainly when we get into the book of the Apocalypse, it's got 7 heads. And those 7 heads, remarkably enough, were the 7 forms of government which the Roman system had. Remember I said that Rome came into existence about 700 odd BC? When it came into existence at that time, it was what was described as a regal kind of constitution. But it went through these various other constitutional forms of government: consular, dictatorial, decemviral, tribunicial, imperial, that's the one we know most about, that's the one which is most famous, and Gothic. Again, Brother Ben gave us an exposition of that yesterday, so that was really useful for us, because the Goths actually overtook Rome. The dates are coming a little bit sparse in my mind. Ben will correct me afterwards, but it's about AD 395 or thereabouts, that the Goths took over Rome. Now, again, this is a fascinating aspect, that the Roman system didn't disappear. You know, there's no Babylonian system today, is there? You cannot go and look at Babylon. It's gone. You can unearth it. You can look at it archaeologically, but it's gone. And so, to a large extent, has the empires of the Medes and the Persians. Persia is there, but it's not like what was. This Roman system still continued throughout many, many centuries. Still in power, but in a divided state and in a different sort of form. And it became a Gothic power. Not that it became a Gothic power as such, but Goths rule. When Odoacer actually took possession of Rome for the first time, he was a Goth, as Brother Ben pointed out to us yesterday, and for that period of 60 years, Goths were sitting in Rome, which would have been unthinkable to somebody like Julius Caesar. And some of those other hideous emperors that Brother Matthew drew our attention to yesterday. Now then, 7 heads. What we do have, and again, this is kind of the thing where I'm really nervous of losing you in the detail here, and I don't want to do that. But the scriptures in the book of the Apocalypse actually says that there were 7 heads, but the 6th head was slain to make way for the 7th, which was Imperial Rome, as you saw on the previous slide, making way for the 7th form of government, which was Gothic. But what the scriptures also tell us was that the 6th head was healed, so that we get a kind of an eighth head. But it was really the sixth head coming back into power. And it came back into power on imperial terms, but not ancient pagan imperial terms. It came back into power as a papal entity. The Roman Catholic system had gained ascendancy. The history of it all is absolutely fascinating and saturates the mind, but can never be really reproduced in the course of one address. Rome was really vying for power. Even when the Goths were there, the ecclesiastical system, somebody made reference to it in the course of the weekend, of what have kings to do with, what has Christians to do with kings, what have bishops to do with court. That was what the Donatists were saying. I think it was Brother Matthew who was saying that the bishops and all, they were vying for power. They were trying to grow, and they basically got power eventually and became the eighth head. It was an imperial, because it was the sixth was the imperial head, and when the Catholics got to power after the Goths, they became an imperial power in their own right, exercising the same kind of inflexible iron rule which the imperial pagan Roman system did as well. And there are those 10 horns. I've just listed them down there, but we don't really need to take much attention to them. But those are some of the invaders of the empire which made part for those 10 horn powers. So the beast and the apocalypse, references, we're going to look at them in chapter order, by and large. But we will flick back and forth a little bit and consider the details briefly. And as I said earlier, we're going to look at the dragon as well. We also want to make this point here. This is an incredibly important point. Brother Thomas makes the point in Eureka. The correct view of the apocalypse, and Brother Ewan has done a capital job for us on showing why the continual historic has been the correct view as opposed to the futurist and the preterist views. If we've got a preterist view, if we've got a futuristic view, we've not got a clear understanding of what God thinks about Catholicism. Now, don't think that we're going out of our way to be scared and against the Catholic system. But in some ways, it's there. The individual Catholic, the individual person, the man, the woman in the street who happens to be Catholic, you know, we're not attacking that individual person, though they may give their support in a time of religious war to the system, of course. But let's be clear on this. We're really talking about the system of Roman Catholicism. This system with its cardinals, its priests, its pope, and the cage of all unclean and hateful birds, as the scripture puts it, is despised by the Spirit. And this address here is actually showing what the Catholic system is all about. We really need to get to grips with that. If we don't understand the apocalypse correctly, we're missing what God is really telling us about the Catholic system in its growth, in its development, and what it's done and is doing to the saints of the Most High God. Okay, we're going to make a start. In chapter 12... Thank you, Brother Matthew, for the slide there. The Battle of Constantine and Maxentius at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. This introduces us to the first beast of the apocalypse, it's actually the Great Red Dragon. As we said, remember, the Great Red Dragon is more of a political rather than a religious power, but this political power gave way to a religious system. So, right, let's just recap. We've got Daniel's fourth beast. We've got Daniel's fourth beast, Imperial Rome, in chapter 12, which is, incidentally, the equivalent to the sixth seal. The details in the sixth seal is the same as chapter 12, the overthrow of paganism. There's the detail, the description. We're told there's a great red dragon there. The identification, we're told it had 7 heads, 10 horns, it was ferocious, and it was a persecuting power. Some of the details in the chapter, chapter 12, show that there were 2 women in the chapter, as it happens. There was a birth, there was a dragon there, waiting to devour the offspring as soon as it was born, and there was a great war in heaven, and the dragon was cast out. And of course, we're not going to waste our time talking about the devil and the understanding that the Jehovah's Witness had in that. We're talking about the time period of AD 312 or 313. So this beast, now as Brother David pointed out to us, I think it was yesterday, in scriptural terms, a woman is likened, or an ecclesiastical system is likened to a woman. I have presented you unto Christ as a chaste virgin, Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. So a woman can stand for an ecclesiastical system, either true or false. A woman being either a truth holder or a woman having lost the truth or apostatized from the truth. It depends on what, how we're looking at it. Paul gives us that clearly to understand. But David also told us in AD 33 there was an apostasy. Ananias and Sapphira thought that they could deceive the Spirit. It wasn't just deceiving Peter, it was deceiving the Spirit. Peter had the Holy Spirit, and they thought that they could deceive God and keep back part of the price. That was the first blot upon the glorious details of the Acts, where thousands were accepting the truth and they had fellowship one with another, and then Ananias and Sapphira spoils it all, as it were, in AD 33. And if you had 280 years, which is the period of gestation, or the pregnancy period, then we get to that 312-313, when the man-child was born. The dragon recognized. The dragon, would you say the dragon was? Imperial Rome? Yeah. The dragon, this fiery red, sinful, red sin dragon, was there. Conscious of the fact that Christianity was growing. The Arrowless Bowman that Brother Matthew talked about, it was advancing through the empire. It was Christianizing the empire. And paganism did not like it. And was ready to try and devour anyone who championed the cause of Christianity, because paganism hated the fact that Christianity was taken away from their worship of Jupiter and Mars. The altars were no longer pouring with the blood of its victims or being offered to Jupiter and Mars, and the pagans did not like it. They resisted it. Constantine proclaimed toleration on the death of his father, and there was the four emperors of Rome at that time, Maxentius, Licinius, I can't remember the other one, and Constantine. Constantine championed the cause of Christianity. Not necessarily true Christianity, of course, but because the time of this, as we see from the letters to the Ecclesias, a great apostasy had taken place. But nevertheless, Christianity, the belief in Christ, was being proclaimed, and Constantine wanted to champion that cause. I mean, he wasn't stupid. He got a ready support. He could see the growth. You know, some people, they have this power to see into the future. Businessmen, you have become successful because they have the ability to see into the future. Constantine could see that, and he championed the cause, as Brother David brought out. He's a bloodthirsty character. He wasn't actually baptized until a week before his death. He had no real interest in it, but he could see the cause of it, and he championed it. And basically, he proclaimed toleration. But paganism resisted, and the dragon fought, tooth and nail, to use an expression. But Constantine was the one who gained the victory. It was quoted about Napoleon, "The hand of God leads my armies." In a sense, God led Constantine's army, because this was all mapped out in the apocalyptic time frame. Paganism had no chance. It was all laid out, but they were going to fight to the death. They recognized that it was going to be a difficult task. And Constantine overpowered Maxentius in Italy, roughly about, I think that was where Brother Matthew's slide was, in the 313 period of time, the Battle of Milvian Bridge. But under Licinius was still going to grapple with that. You might remember the words someone's quoted in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 7. "For the mystery of iniquity doth already work, only he who now let us will let until he be taken out of the way." Paul recognized even in his day that false Christianity was taking place to such an extent that he could see that the whole of true Christianity was going to be lost. But the manifestation of the wicked one, as Paul refers to in 2 Thessalonians, was being held back. There was a great desire by apostate Christianity to take control of the empire, if it could, but it was being held back by paganism. That was what Paul saw in 2 Thessalonians. In Apocalypse chapter 12, when we were in the presence of the dragon, Licinius took the reins of the dragon, if you like, and was going to try his best to defeat Christianity. But Constantine obtained a complete victory at the Battle of Adrianople at Chrysoprasus in AD 324, and was basically successful. The dragon was cast out of heaven. It was cast out. Paganism lost its end. Heaven symbolizes the ruling powers, the earth, the people who are ruled upon. The dragon, if you can apocalyptically see the vision, was cast out of heaven. and the woman, the apostate woman, was going to take its place. But paganism was ready there to devour Constantine, the man-child who was born after 280 days gestation, ready there to devour it, but was unsuccessful and actually lost its power. Many more details in chapter 12, of course, but basically that's the idea. The true ecclesia, there's another woman mentioned in that 12th chapter towards the end, the true ecclesia had to flee into the wilderness. Somebody made reference to that, might have been Brother David. Flee into northern Africa, where the earth, symbolic of the secular powers, probably a better way of describing it, where the inhabitants of the earth who hated oppression, particularly the I can't remember the name now, but they fought against, they hated tyranny. They had a club called the Israelites, Circumcellions. I read Sister Allison's lips then. The Circumcellions, they basically resisted and they helped the true woman. They helped her and protected her. So the dragon, i.e. the military power of the Christianized Roman Empire, was persecuted those who opposed Catholicism. You see what was happening there? That's a bit of a mouthful, that last one there. But what I'm trying to say on that slide there is that when Constantine got to power, it wasn't then a matter of paganism persecuting Christians. It was this Christian power which had now taken the reins of the empire and was now attempting to persecute the true holders of the truth, who were now an extreme minority by that time. So we're at the point of the time in history where that pagan imperial power of Rome had well and truly gone now, and the Christian power had taken possession, and basically Rome was the centre of what was going to happen. Quick list of what I would describe as historical notes there. The dragon lost its power, that's pagan Rome. A lot of it had been weakened, Brother Ben brought out yesterday, by the wind trumpets, the judgment on the Roman Empire through that particular period. So the sixth head was really losing its power, and it lost it imperially to the Gothic seventh head. And another wild beast arose, which was the healed sixth head. So the dragon, it says in chapter 13, which we're now going to be able to look at in a few moments, gave him his power and his seat and great authority. So this imperial Roman power had got to a situation where it had lost its power in the empire. But circumstances had changed in Rome then, or in the empire as such. Christianity had taken its place, and there was still a military power in existence, seated now more in Constantinople, because when Constantine came to power, he moved his seat of authority, if you like, from Rome to Constantinople. He had that big city. He had this dream, didn't he, that he was being led by, was it Mary, and someone said, well, you've marked out the city, this is an ample city as it is. He said, I think he might have seen a cross before him or whatever. And he mapped out the huge city of Constantinople. And he basically put down, there we get the two legs of the empire, of the image of Rome. It was basically divided at that particular point in time. You can see the beginning of this division. So, we come now to the beast of the sea. The beast of the sea. Let's have a look at the description of that beast. It arose out of the Mediterranean. So we in the kind of the area of the Mediterranean. Remember, Italy comes out, juts out into the Mediterranean. The identification, it's got 7 heads, it's got 10 horns. It says it's like a leopard. It's got the feet of a bear, the mouth of a lion. It's ferocious. It's blasphemous. And it's a persecuting power. Those are all the details in Revelation 13, 1-8, which we haven't got time to read. But those are its identification. And again, we've got the same. We might have had that great red dragon that we've considered. The same characteristics are there. The one that Daniel saw, which was imperial Rome, spanning into a religious system with that little horn, with eyes and a mouth. He saw it all condensed in that one beast. When we come to the book of Revelation, we're given various visions to depict those various epochs of time. Some of the details, the deadly wound was healed. Remember we said the sixth imperial head was slain, giving way to the Gothic seventh, but it was healed and became an eighth head, which is the sixth head healed. It made war with the saints and it wondered after the beast. It worshipped the beast. So that's about the time period there, 395 to 799, that we're looking at. So, the power of Constantinople waned. Really, the military power of the empire, by the time we're looking at about the 4th century, was really now established in Constantinople. You remember the map of Europe when you've got the, you know, the France, Belgium, Spain, Italy, and then you get over here, you know, Turkey, what we call it today, but then it would have been Istanbul is the modern capital. Constantinople is what it used to be. It's also called the Byzantine Empire as its power developed. In that particular area, there was really the military power of Rome when Constantine moved his power from Rome to Constantinople. But the power was waning. The power was waning. And again, you know, this is really a top-level review of all this. The details are quite expansive. So the dragon, really, the power in Constantinople was losing its power over the horns, over the territory where the horns had invaded. It was really not really exercising such a great support anymore. But it still supported Rome. It still supported this ecclesiastical power, which was now growing in Rome. There was that Gothic period for 60 years, but when that beast was healed, when that head was healed, there was a vacuum in Rome. Rome had the Caesars there, then it had the Goths, and after the Goths were defeated by Constantinople, by the power, the military power that came across from Constantinople, there was started to be a vacuum in Rome. Historically, there was a vacuum there. It had always had a Caesar or a strong rulership in Rome, and then it had gone. These military leaders had waned away. Constantinople was becoming a weaker existence, and a vacuum was starting to develop in Rome itself. Now, Brother David, yesterday in his remarks, made reference to two people, Justinian and Phocas. Justinian was one of the emperors that ruled in the east in Constantinople, and he gave ecclesiastical primacy to the Bishop of Rome. He said, you know, the Bishop of Rome ought to be, you know, more important perhaps than others. He also made his, I can't remember, the laws which Justinian made, as Brother David made reference to yesterday, actually disseminated throughout the Roman Empire and actually became the law and the legal codes which has really given rise to the kind of continental Europe that we have today. Very far-reaching effects in what Justinian laid down. David, I think it was Brother David made reference yesterday to the fact about what was the definition of toleration. Well, you might be religiously acceptable, providing you didn't have any peculiar beliefs. And this all goes back, as Brother David said yesterday, to Justinian. I thought it was a very interesting point that Brother David made. Phocas, in 610, he did proclaim the Pope as universal bishop in AD 610. And you're probably thinking, or you may be thinking, you can fit in some of the historical detail with the dates that Brother David put on some of those dates. You know, the 1260 days that started from 610 and so on and so forth. So the emperors in the east were now really bolstering up the papal system, the ecclesiastical system of false Christianity, which was in Rome and growing in power. There was no sort of military there, so there was like a vacuum, and they were filling it. They were filling it. So Rome ecclesiastical had now become imperial. And it drew millions of admirers. It says that they wondered after the beast in chapter 13. The Apostle Paul says, "Who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, that he is God, sitteth in the temple of God, showing that he is a God." They wondered after the beast. They wondered after this system which was developing. It drew millions of admirers. But it was blasphemous. That's, as far as God was concerned, its beliefs, its ideology, its actions were all blasphemous to the truth of the Most High God. And we notice in verse 10, it refers to the patience and faith of the saints. This growing power was there in Rome, growing now as an ecclesiastical, imperial sixth head or eighth head, and the saints of the Most High God had to live contemporaneously with that system. here is the patience and the faith of the saints. Their endurance in the time of ecclesiastical tyranny, when they had to try and live their lives in accordance with the commandments of Christ. So we'll stop there and consider the next beast. This is described as the beast of the earth. So we're moving on. We've gone from, and I hope this has remained relatively clear, otherwise I'll have lost the plot for you. We've gone from imperial Rome to ecclesiastical Rome, where the popes were now really getting power and being supported, albeit a bit of a waning support, from Constantinople. But their bishops, their emperors rather, in Constantinople were really supporting this power of Rome, and the bishops and the popes. This system of religion was this healed six-head power. We're now coming to consider the beast of the earth. And again, it's the same power. It's in those different phases. As we said, the Anglo-Saxon power, the Plantagenets, the Tudors, the Hanoverians, and so on and so forth. Here we've got, the imperial Rome, ecclesiastical imperial Rome. And now what have we got? We've got this beast with two horns that came up out of the earth, not out of the sea this time. It came out of the earth. And it came out of the earth because its power base now was not Mediterranean based. It was based in Central and Northern Europe. But again, look at the identification. Seven heads, ten horns, persecuting. Fire comes down from heaven. It's a persecuting, ferocious power that we are being presented with again. So this is the point that I'm trying to say. That beast that we saw in Daniel, it gives us the key to what the apocalypse is all about, as far as the beast is concerned, and other things probably. But it's given us this same beast. These identification marks are reminding us. We're still talking about that same two legs of iron, that same fourth beast in different phases. It looked like a lamb. You go and ask an independent person out on the street these days, what do you think about the Roman Catholic system? Oh, he's a lovely man. That Pope is a lovely man. Especially John Paul II. I'm not quite sure about Ratzinger, the current one. But John Paul II, he basically, oh, what a lovely man. Mother Teresa. Oh, look at all the good work she's done. Look at all the money that's disappeared. But you get the picture? It looks like a lamb, but it speaks like a dragon. But the deceptive point is there. It looks like a lamb. Catholicism looks like a lamb. It never used to look like a lamb to the Protestants, even in this country. But they've been overthrown. They've been conquered. It looks like a lamb, but it really speaks like a dragon. For those who really understand what emanates from that little horn that came up and displaced the three before it, and which was the Exarchate of Rome, Ravenna, and I can't remember the other one, but I'm not speaking on Daniel anyway. But it had mouth, a mouth of blasphemy. It spoke like a dragon, and it had two horns. Okay, what were those two horns? I'm just going to say what the two horns are, just in case I haven't got it down on my slide, because I don't think I have. The two horns, this system as it developed, was made up principally of a religious power and a secular power, and they were very closely allied. What I've got on there, on that slide there, is Constantinople, by the time we're looking at this particular period of history, was now totally unable to support the papal system. Remember, the papal system is an ecclesiastical system. It doesn't itself have an army. Okay? It doesn't itself have an army. But it depends on others who do. Constantinople was losing power through what Brother Ben told us about yesterday, through the rise of Islam. In AD 622, Muhammad had started off a revolution which was going to really hit a hole in the power of Constantinople. And Brother Ben gave us an outline of that yesterday, and particularly with the not only the fifth trumpet, but the sixth trumpet, the four Euphratian angels that came and actually in 1453 overthrew the power of Constantinople. They were unable, they had enough to do to keep these Muslims out. That was the principal aim now of Constantinople, was to defend itself against these who came up from the pit of the abyss, as Brother Ben described interestingly to us yesterday. They had enough to do to contain that power, let alone sail their boats across the Bosphorus and try to support Rome and all that needed to support there. There were also divisions within the church as well. We haven't gone into the history of that, but the basically church, as we know, split up into East and West, which is kind of interesting when you have Greek and Roman, the aspects of the image as well come out with the Latin element and the Greek element. We know that there's the Latin or the Western Church, and there's the Greek Orthodox Church. Well, all that division, you know, the popes are clean-shaven. In the Greek Orthodox, they've got long beards. They've got all sorts of differences between them. They're trying to unite back now in this, the time of the end. But these divisions weakened some of the church, and particularly those of Constantinople, because they were more towards the Eastern aspect of it. And the Lombards took advantage of this weakness within the church. These were a group of people that were within the empire. And they laid claim to Rome. And the Pope sought new alliances. And he turned to Pepin, who was the king of the Franks. Now that was more Central Europe. So this is why he was the beast of the earth. And Pepin was quite helpful to the papal system. He was favourable to them. And in AD 787, Rome became allied to Charlemagne, which was Pepin's son. Charlemagne actually uprooted those three powers, including the Lombards, and basically thwarted all attempts to oust the papal system from the state of Rome. Pope Leo III actually crowned Charlemagne as Augustus and Emperor in AD 79. And thus, history started what is known as the Holy Roman Empire. It had been in the making a little bit before 799. But basically, Charlemagne was crowned by the papal system. Now that was a first. This was a major, secular, powerful, military king being crowned by the Pope. Two horns. Religious and secular. Political and ecclesiastical. Interestingly enough, I asked some of our visiting brethren over breakfast or something, did they know what the First Reich was. They knew what the Third Reich was. The Third Reich was the Empire of Germany. Hitler established the Third Reich, and everybody's heard of it. But what people haven't heard of is the Second and First. And if I can ever remember the Second, it was something, that was German as well, around about the beginning of the 1900s, it was the Emperor of the Hohenzollerns, or something to that effect. But the First Reich was the Holy Roman Empire. My watch going slow, more fast. I better go on very quickly. So these are the two aspects that we've got. It is speaking of dragon, and Paul makes reference to this evilness of unrighteousness. Oops. Chapter 13. What we've also got in chapter 13, which we wanted to make mention about, was the image of the beast. We also have in the last four verses or so in that chapter, it says they made an image to the beast, and again, it's like another development. Where we had this kind of like joint thing with this two-horned beast, with the power of the emperor, at that time it was Charlemagne, and the Pope, what we find in the latter part of this is the further development of papal power. The scripture, again, is a two-horned beast, compels an image to be made like to the beast which had the wound. So the image itself, the beast itself, is compelling an image to be made and people to worship it. Identification, it's persecuting and it's domineering. Again, we haven't got time to turn those verses up. But again, those same characteristics are there. It's domineering and there's a persecuting power. And it has this, it says everyone to buy and sell has to have a mark. And an identification there, 666. That was the identification. The image is the Pope, and I'm going to have to be very quick through this, but the Holy Roman Empire that had been established, it gave political and ecclesiastical power to the beast by compelling men to worship Catholicism. So the beast system of Europe, that European empire, if you like, which is now the Holy Roman Empire, in very, very close alliance with the Pope, was now actually saying, let's worship the Pope, let's bring power to the Pope. Actually, it was a little bit more than that, because when we look at it, we actually find that the Popes themselves were working very closely behind the scene to try and get power. There was one, I believe his name was Adrian, who was really trying to grip the power of the empire for himself. He didn't see it, but his successor did, the man by the name of Hildebrand, who became, I can't remember his name, Gregory the Seventh. He became the Pope Gregory the Seventh, a man called Hildebrand. He was particularly powerful and influential. He basically enabled the papal system to take complete dominance. Even though it was the Holy Roman Empire, it now became a position where the popes held sway. And there was one of the kings of Europe by the name of Henry. I haven't noted the detail down of the year, but he came to the Pope, and the Pope put him in the depths of winter, and he had to wait for days in freezing cold before he had an audience to see the Pope. There's other historical details, Brother Thomas brings them all out, but the Pope actually kicks the crown off one of the potentates of Europe to indicate he had the power to raise up kings or to put them down. And in this particular period of time, the papal system ruled sway. No one could buy or sell unless they had the papal mark of Catholicism indelibly in their system and in their thinking, and they subscribed to the papal system. Brother Thomas says it was an independent imperial dynasty occupying the relative position to the lamb-horned beast that the blasphemous mouth does to Daniel's horn. So it was very similar. This image of the beast was part of the beast itself, just like the little horn was connected to the blasphemous mouth does to Daniel's little horn. So you get that papal horn in the mouth, it had the same relation as the imperial dynasty occupying relatives. I'm sorry, I'm not making myself very clear, but I'm really conscious of the time that's flying by this now. The massacre of St. Bartholomew. I can't remember which of the brethren made reference to this, but this is just a fleeting reference to this other beast system here. That's a really harrowing sort of scene there, where men, women and children were literally being butchered at the end of the witnessing period that Brother David referred to, of 1,260 years, from AD 312 to 1572, when there was this great massacre. The Edict of Nantes had been revoked, and there was a massacre of the Huguenots, and that was referred to in chapter 11, verse 7 of the Apocalypse. It talks about, and we haven't got the time to turn this up, but it talks about a beast that ascended out of the abyss. The abyss was Europe. And again, really in chapter 11, it gives the details before we've had the final details that came later in chapter 12 and chapter 13. But again, that one verse reference in chapter 11, verse 7, it said the beast which arose out of the abyss is reference to this papal power which had such great authority and such an inflexible rule over the nations of Europe. Again, the details are there. It was a persecuting power. It was at the time of the two witnesses and the end of their testimony, and there was great rejoicing made over them. It was that massacre of Bartholomew when the witnesses ceased to testify. The Diagogue, incidentally, describes it when it says that the beast that arose, it described it as a wild beast that came from that European abyss then, persecuted the Huguenots. The next reference that we have in the Apocalypse, and in a sense, we've kind of just. I'm not developing epochs of time now. I'm actually going to specific verses. But in a sense, I'm kind of looking to the days in which we live in. In chapter 16, Brother Glendon may well bring a little bit more out. In chapter 16, verse 13, in the sixth vial that was poured out under the seventh trumpet, John saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, the beast and the false prophet. Now look, we've looked at the dragon, haven't we? And we said the dragon, really its power was a sin power, it was a political power, and it moved its sphere of influence to Constantinople. It tried to support as much as it could, remember, the papal system, it waned in its power. John saw three spirits unclean spirits come out of the mouth of the dragon. The beast, we've seen the beast, Europe, it had different forms, didn't it? Its power bases were around the Mediterranean, then Central Europe, but it was that same imperial kind of system which was dominating Europe. Now, in the time of the Holy Roman Empire, its capital, if you like, was in Austria. That was really the seat of the beast. That was where the great power resolved itself eventually and lasted there up until 1870, which was the end of that other 1,260 years when the temporal power of the Pope came to an end. But that was in Austria. And the false prophet, we know what the false prophet is. And the false prophet is the papal system. Again, we haven't got time to look at all the details on that. But what John saw in the sixth vial, and we are living in the sixth vial period, he saw this unclean spirit with an influence coming from Constantinople, coming from Austria, Central Europe, and from Italy. And he says, what I'm going to suggest to you, and I'm not going to spend any time on it, it's the influence of France, because it was a frog power. The influence of France operating on those three centres. And I believe personally that we need to look with the signs of the times to see France influencing in these three centres at some point, of bringing them to, it says in the rest of that verse, gathering to the day of the great day of God Almighty. There is the spirit of demons, it says, demonia, the spirit of madness, which currently occupies the world. You know, you see things happening in the world, you think it's mad. That's the time period we're living in. I believe we will see the influence of France emerging to bring about the great day of God Almighty. We couldn't finish our address without referring to the scarlet coloured beast. It's the same beast. John sees this in chapter 17, and he sees it with a woman on it. Some of the difficulties of this is that we tend to be mixing the figures up a little bit. Well, yeah, I guess we are, really. But it's only to enhance our understanding. Just keep in memory that fourth beast of Daniel, there's different phases it's going through. This is its final phase. It's in the time of its perdition, a time when it will cease to exist. John sees it. He sees it in the wilderness. The identification is still the same. 7 heads, 10 horns. He sees it blasphemous. The details are, there's a woman riding it, which is a harlot. It describes it as a harlot. The gorgeous attire that this woman has, and she's got a forehead with Babylon mystery religion, and she's drunk. She's intoxicated. But she's not intoxicated with liquor, she's intoxicated with blood. Brother Arthur, I think it was, made reference over the weekend to Fox's Book of Martyrs. If we don't think that Catholic system is drunk with blood, then pick up, before you do anything else, pick up Fox's Book of Martyrs, and if your stomach will take it, read that book. If you're not convinced already of what that system is all about. It isn't a terrible mistake. They've gone out of their way to persecute the saints of the Most High God. The time period we're given about this is 1 hour, which is a future period when she will be destroyed. The wilderness, we believe, is Europe. The whore that rides it is the Catholic system. He sees this great whore, the great apostasy, drunk with the blood of God's people who have been slain in thousands over the earth. The earth is soaked in the blood of those who will not accept the teachings of Catholicism. And it's a scarlet beast. And John sees this political reorganization of the beast at the time of the end. So he actually sees the beast being reorganized at the time of the end, just prior to its destruction. So we look into a time period when the beast will be re-energized, if you like. It's still kind of in a way, it's there in a dormant state, if you like. He sees it with a woman on it. Now, the history of current Europe, the European common market, shows quite clearly its core. It was set up on the Treaty of Rome. When they go on, I can't remember if it's Strasbourg or one of the other centres where they start discussing things, they meet under their tables to discuss European politics, and sadly Britain's amongst them, but they meet with one of the popes with his hand outstretched over the top of them. One of the popes, either Boniface or Innocent, one of these ignominious beasts themselves, he's there with his hand over them. Roman Catholicism is supervising the nations as they meet in Europe. Britain has no part in there, she should never have been in there, but at the time of the end, if she doesn't leave voluntarily, she'll be thrown out. There's no doubt about that. Babylon the Great, that's what she's got. She's got 10 horns, gives power to the nations of Europe, and she's got an existence when she really grips power of 30 years. We believe, as Brother Thomas says, that she has power 1 hour with the beast. Roman Catholicism has 30 years existence where she will, in characteristic madness, thinks that she can extinguish the power that has emerged in the earth, which is Christ and the saints. But she's overcome. The Lamb overcomes them. She's the stone power. The Ancient of Days, Christ overcomes the Catholic system. Chapter 19, we were looking at chapter 17 there. Chapter 18 describes that city of Roman Catholicism. Chapter 19 gives us details after the Alleluia chorus and the marriage of Christ and the saints. It gives us details of the taking of the beast. It tells us in chapter 19, it's that same beast power. So when we're reading about the beast, it's that same system, but in the last period now of its existence. And Brother Thomas, incidentally, says in Eureka, he says, how can wrath cease against men so long as there is Catholicism? The divine anger will only be appeased with her extirpation, total and complete. There's the identification mark again. I saw the beast, John said. I saw the beast. It's the same one. We haven't got the details of 7 heads and 10 horns. We've already been given that. John said, I saw the beast. It's the same one. It's the same one through which history has downtrodden God's people. What a glorious privilege we have, as Brother Ewan has pointed out. I can give a lecture here today. We'd be frightened listening to this lecture a few hundred years ago, wouldn't we? We'd be really apprehensive. I would. I know I'd be. It's okay for me to be big and brave and say it up here, but I know that if they were like Dragon Age or whatever they might have been called, you know, watching for people who were meeting together. We're very, very well blessed. So the details are there again. They made war against Christ and ultimately were cast into the lake of fire. Time period, 1 hour. This was the final attempt of Roman Catholicism to destroy the truth. And they think, boy, this is it. What's happened? An unknown power has emerged in the Middle East. It's overthrown the host of Russia. Russia with all the nations. How on earth could anyone overthrow such a massive army? It's one of the biggest armies. Russia and the nations of Ezekiel 38 is one of the biggest armies that will ever have been assembled. And it's been defeated. And not only that, this power is favourable to the Jews. Not only that, this power is building a temple for the Jews. Roman Catholicism has that as one of her prophecies, that a power will emerge in the time of the end, favourable to the Jews, that will build a temple. They will think their apostate prophecies are coming fulfilled, are being fulfilled at an alarming rate, and they'll be right, but they're on the wrong end of the fulfilment, because Christ comes and destroys the blinding madness of Catholicism when they try to make war against him. There will be, the cry will have gone out, the Aeonian gospel will have been proclaimed, some of the sensible nations, the sheep nations, will have laid down their position before Christ, accepted it. The goat nations will refuse, and in their mad desire to cling to power, will try to bolster up an army against Christ. And over a period of 30 years, they will be ground to powder. As Daniel chapter 2 says, the image is smitten on the feet and down it comes, but the grinding power of the stone will smash and grind the image up over a period of 30 years until the European beast will be taken and conquered, and that false prophet who animates it, the papal system, and headed by the Pope, will be cast into the fire burning with brimstone. And it says in chapter 20, the dragon survives. And Brother David interestingly made that point yesterday. It laid hold of the dragon, that old serpent, who is the devil and Satan. Sin manifested against the deity and his truth. This is the dragon system. The beast system of Roman Catholicism has been destroyed, but human nature survives. A bit like, you know, in the days of the flood. The wicked antediluvians were destroyed. But what survived? Flesh survived the flood. It went through the flood and manifested itself soon after. Well, so in this time, the Catholic system is destroyed. While the other beasts of Daniel chapter 7 allowed to be retained their territory, the lion, bear and leopard, the fourth beast, it says, was destroyed and his body given to the burning flame. total annihilation, fourth beast power is destroyed, but the dragon survives because the dragon is more political system and symbolizes sin. It's a sin power typified by the devil and Satan. The devil is symbolical, isn't it? Sin in the flesh. Satan, that which it opposes, it's an adversary to the truth. It's the old serpent, it's the sin power, but now it's held in chain for 1,000 years. That's my last slide. I don't think I've done bad time. I saw it with a sea of glass, which had been mingled. This is Brother Ewan had that chapter read to me. And them that had gotten the victory over the beast and over his image and over his mark and over the number of his name stand on the sea of glass, having the hearts of God. Somebody made reference to the fact that we'll be standing, we hope, side by side with brethren and sisters. And we feel somewhat humbled when you think that those other brothers and sisters from other centuries lost their lives. Their blood was poured out in copious measure because they would not allow the beast system to gain the victory over them. They would not allow their Bibles to be thrown to the flames. They would not concur with the blasphemous systems of Rome. They gained the victory, and they will be exercising the judgments in the future age. I think it's appropriate that that is the last slide, brothers and sisters, because I don't think any of us here would be able to be conquered by Mariolatry, the belief that Mary is the Mother of God, or transubstantiation, that when the priest eats the bread and drinks the wine, it literally becomes the body and blood of Christ. I don't think any of us here would bow down to the Pope. I don't think any of us will accept all its blasphemous teachings, from the Trinity to the devil to the various other things. I don't think any of us are in danger of that. But I think we're in danger of the more subtle forms of Rome's teaching. I tried to think about this. God going to expect more of those who lost their lives years ago than he is of us? I don't think so. So what is the beast doing to us? Each one of us needs to look at that individually, perhaps. But you know, when we did our exhibition last year, we all learned a phenomenal amount about the King James Bible. I believe, brethren and sisters, and I think Brother Ewan has got more information on this than I do, that the modern versions that we have at our disposal today are basically backed by the papal system. Why? Because the Protestant King James Version shows all too clearly the truth. I'm not saying it's perfect. No, it's got its drawbacks, it's got its bits and pieces which, you know, not quite right. But it's the best translation. The modern translations that Christadelphians are sucking in like mad, you know. And I'm not saying, you know, I've used various translations myself, Brother Matthew would tell me. But by and large, this is the work of Rome. The modern NIV and all these kind of translations, they're all the work of Rome, Westcott and Hort, Catholics. There's various other things. Who do you think's got charge of the media? I haven't got a statistic on this, but I hear that Catholicism has got huge stakes in the media. You know, the silver screen, pouring out its rubbish and its filth. We could be taking all that filth and all that wickedness in. The very lives that we lead and the various medias that we come in contact with, the people at work maybe, they can all be stumbling blocks to us. They can indeed. We do have to, even in our relatively comfortable, non-persecuting days, be sensitive to the work of Rome in its various ways. Rome has no morals. You look at, if you're interested, the book called Rank Sister of the Pope, I don't have it, but you know, I've read certain amount of the details of the Pope. Read Rank's History of the Popes. There's no morality in the Roman Catholic system, you know. I do have a book called Awful Disclosures, which Brother Steve and Sister Liz gave me. You can borrow that if you want and have a read of that. Took place in Canada too, by the way, the details in this book. There's no morals in Rome. The tree that was cut down, the Babylonian tree. Babylon doesn't exist, I said. Yeah? Yeah, it's true, but its influence does. Babylon. Mystery Babylon. The great. Babylon, bound with Greek and Latin vines, is the world that we have in embryo today. I really will stop now because I know I'm going past my time. And I will just leave that slide for us to consider that we will be amongst them, that the beast does not have the victory over us, that we have to help one another so that we can be amongst those who will be with the Lamb, with the 144,000 in that great day.